Welcome to Session 9 of the PDH online course on the 2008 National Electric Code. Chapter 7 is a strange animal in the 2008 National Electric Code. The present name is Special Conditions. As in previous editions, it contains requirements and prohibitions for emergency systems, legally required standby systems, and optional standby systems. Originally, this meant generators and wiring between emergency generators and emergency loads. Very simple, very easy to get your eyes around, and pretty easy to install, because the rule was keep it simple, keep it isolated from the rest of the distribution system, make sure it works when you need it. Those requirements and prohibitions are still present, elaborated slightly, but the big change is the addition of a new class, Critical Operations Power Systems, COPS. COPS requirements are more stringent than life safety system, but the code is very ambiguous under what conditions this section applies. I was doing electrical design for a large municipal central security monitoring facility, which, incidentally, was to include all the billing computers for municipal services and utilities. The city decided this was not a critical operation in the meaning of the National Electric Code. They also lost Homeland Security funding because it wasn't built underground. As suggested in the introduction, emergency systems are life safety loads. You must purchase a generator set with emergency system UL rating. It must start in 10 seconds, run for 90 minutes, the transfer switch must be UL listed for an emergency system, and all load wiring must be kept separate from general purpose wiring. Now again, I insist this is simple, straightforward, unambiguous, and you can understand it. There's nothing to argue with anybody about. Let me repeat it. You must purchase a generator with an emergency system UL listing. It must start in 10 seconds, run for 90 minutes, the transfer switch must be UL listed for emergency systems, and all load wiring must be kept separate from general purpose wiring. Clean and straightforward. It starts getting messy when you start looking for exceptions and special cases and ways to save, and you can save several thousand dollars by using these provisions, but over a 20-year life, several thousand dollars may not be a bargain depending on what comes down the road. And again, this is special to your project. Note that general purpose loads may be fed by the generator, but they must have a separate transfer switch which automatically sheds when the system is in trouble. NFPA recommends this use, believing there will be an incentive for generator installation and maintenance. Because both emergency and general purposes can be fed from the generator, there is no reason to distinguish emergency, legal standby, optional standby generators. Spend a little more and get a premium installation capable of supporting emergency loads in the future, even if battery pack emergency egress lighting is being used in the present project. Article 705. Now notice we're still within Chapter 7, which used to be just emergency generators. Now we're going way off the wall. Section 705 of the National Electric Code relates to parallel interconnections with utility service. This is intended for cogeneration facilities for large industrials, as well as for vacation cabin photovoltaic arrays or wind power or water power generators. The reason for interconnection is that cogeneration and eco-friendly generation typically do not meet all of the load requirements, including startup and maintenance. With utility deregulation, generating and transmission shortages, and heavy ecological marketing, interconnection has been accepted by some utilities. Note that this is a seriously bad idea for many reasons. First, utility linemen repairing downed lines depend on radio information and their dispatchers that the lines are dead. Yes, they can put on ground jumpers, and probably someday will, but a customer backfeed would be a really bad idea in these circumstances. And remember, we're talking about maintenance under emergency circumstances. It's not well thought out, follow the procedures. Now, I say that, and I kick myself for saying it. Utility linemen are some of the best trained maintenance people in the world, and they really have the safety procedures built into them. But don't energize a line that they think is dead. It's just something we don't want to do. Second, most of the cogeneration and eco-friendly installations are hobby quality. The utilities are extremely careful about all aspects of their generation and switching. A paperboard mill that exports a few milliwatts, however, will not have the same level of maintenance or care. The eco-friendly generator stations I have inspected have been abominations. It's bad enough when the local battery storage faults, but when it's hard connected to the utility, it can produce a really big flash. And utility protection is for shorts. An arcing load fault at the end of a long secondary service line may not be picked up by the primary fusing feeding the transformer for the area. Now, that's not to say that parallel connection's a bad idea. It just says that it deserves a lot more care than is obvious. It's not going to sit there and run by itself for 20 years. It's going to require very careful initial installation and occasional checkout to make sure that, well, just for instance, the batteries. Batteries don't last 5 years. So if you're counting on batteries to run your system, you count on buying more batteries. Article 708, Critical Operation Power Systems. Two interesting requirements are that the generator must have full load test capability, which certainly implies a load bank. The need has been debated by engineers and salesmen for years. The information people have agreed, if you see TIA 942, which I think was mentioned previously, and it is required by the National Electric Code for critical operation power systems. The second somewhat interesting requirement is shielding for all signal and communications cable. Shielding is somewhat new to economic local area data networks and strongly recommended for 10 gigabits per second or higher. Shielding on telephone lines is totally outside your author's experience, but most telephone systems are migrating to voice over IP, VOIP, using the data system rather than dedicated wiring. Surge protection devices are required at all voltage levels. Now, this is a special case. All previous sections of surge protection devices, they were optional. They are not required at the service. They are not required at panel boards. They are not required at critical loads, except under Article 708, Critical Operation Power Systems, where they are required. So a general answer, like if you saw a quiz question, where are they required? They're not required. Very special case for critical operation power systems. It's, however, becoming standard in commercial design. So it's not a change, but it's a checkoff item before plan submission for critical operations power systems. Article 725, Class 1, 2, and 3 circuits. Class 1 circuits look and smell like power circuits, except that 16 AWG and 18 AWG are permitted. Application is line voltage remote control devices such as push button stations, limit switches, or maybe light curtains. Typically, Class 2 and 3 circuits are part of vendor-supplied systems as doorbell, annunciation, HVAC control, or public address. But special mention is made of thermocouple and process instrumentation. The examples in the 2008 National Electric Code Handbook include data and telephone in Section 25, but the chapter is dedicated to communications with a lot of telephone and fair amount of data cabling. That's Chapter 8 is dedicated to communications cabling. Class 1, 2, and 3 circuits must be identified as such at the terminal and junction boxes. And again, these are special low current circuits that are not supposed to be as low voltage, low current. Sidebar discussion of labeling voltage levels. I take NEC requirements very seriously. This section requires labeling low voltage circuits. Previous sections required labeling each voltage level present in a facility. It is easy to buy 480 volt, 240 volt, 120-208, and 120 volt labels. It is nearly impossible to buy 50 volt labels or 24 volt labels. Usually, low voltage labeling is done by an indelible felt pen. 760 fire alarms. PhD Online offers a separate course exclusively dedicated to fire alarms. It's called E207 regarding NFPA 72. Because that topic is too important for superficial review, your attention is drawn to the specialized course and it will not be addressed here. Article 770, fiber optic cable. Aha, now we're getting into the interesting stuff. Well, interesting because it's new at least. Article 770 presents requirements and prohibitions regarding fiber optic cable. This is important because standards usually followed in fiber optic installation, BICSI and TIA, are enforceable only through the construction contract. The National Electric Code is externally enforced by the public electrical inspector, who has authority to stop work on the project and introduce substantial delays and associated costs. Another very interesting aspect of the rules for fiber optic installation is that they reflect the transition of the National Electric Code from concern over electricity starting a fire to cable insulation communicating the fire to previously uninvolved areas. The rules in Article 770 relate to non-combustible cable jackets, removing abandoned cables, and acceptable mounting to permit access for maintenance and firefighting. The only close relation of fiber optic cables to electric cables is the metallic external sheath or internal metallic strength member, which may be present. When present, it must be grounded to avoid transmission of lightning surges and maintain an equal potential environment for personnel safety. Grounding of fiber optic cable comes under the inter-system ground bus introduced by 2008 National Electric Code in Section 250.94. Typically, a number 6 AWG conductor from the fiber breakout point back to the ground bus is acceptable. There is wording requiring the ground be applied where the cable first enters the building, but exceptions permitting completing the run to the data entrance room in the data center are present. TIA 942 recommends keeping the access provider technicians out of the working data center. The entrance room is walled off. The service areas are illustrated in the following slide put on the internet by C. Domenico at IEEE.org. And as I move down to the picture, beautiful PowerPoint slide. I'll try to read it to you. It's called Relationship of Spaces. Actually, this came up because there is a very slight difference between the IEEE 802.3 requirement and the TIA 942 requirement. Now, in my opinion, and this is not a fact, this is just an opinion, TIA 942 is a better document. It's more thought out, and the results make a lot more sense intuitively. Now, IEEE is a great organization, and obviously they put serious effort into it. But keep in mind, TIA 942 came later, so they were able to use the good thinking that IEEE produced and build upon it. But looking at the drawing in the PDH online course, which was taken off public domain internet, relationship of spaces starts with the building site. That's the big box outside. Then the building shell. That seems like a strange thing to identify, but I guess, yeah, there is a perimeter of the building. Oh, okay, the site would include the trees and the parking lots. The shell is just the perimeter of the building. Now, outside the data center, and this is what's interesting about this, is general office space, telecom rooms and equipment rooms, office space, support, spare. Now, according to IEEE, inside the data center is support staff spaces, entrance rooms, data center electrical and mechanical rooms, operations center, telecom rooms, storage rooms, and loading docks. Then one step closer inside the data center is what they call the computer room, which we would probably call the server area. Now, the point of IEEE is to keep the entrance room out of the server area. Yeah, that makes sense. You don't want the outside access providers wandering around your computer room. But do you really want them to wander around your cross-connect locations? So the TIA goes one step further and moves the entrance room out of the data center. Well, maybe nominally inside the data center, but no doors into the working data center, only doors into the outside area. You want it in close proximity so your wires are as short as possible. I mean, at current data rates, short wires are essential. But you don't want strangers wandering around your facility. Sidebar discussion of TIA 942. Several articles and trade publications have referenced 2005 TIA 942. All favorable comments are endorsed here. It's a comprehensive, understandable, detailed standard for good data center installation. Mr. Domenico's PowerPoint presentation came back as an early hit on a Google search for TIA 942. There are 36 slides which eloquently introduce the topic without watering it down. The entire 148 document of TIA 942 is available from a place called TIAonline.org. An extremely valuable component is the extended table in the back, which relates uptime qualification, that's tier 1 through 4, to specific facility features. The content is fully understandable, but not fully intuitive until you study the standard. Now, let me say this again. The reason is I've been mentioning this to people I work with, and they say, "What are you talking about, Tom?" They've never heard of TIA 942, and they've never heard of uptime qualification tier 1 through 4. Well, these are people who are living in a different world than I am. If you have an industry where computer operation is critical to continued operation. I'm not saying critical to success, I'm saying just continued operation. Then you've got to know about the Uptime Institute. These are the people who tell you how to keep your computer system online. At the end of the day, they rank every institution as tier 1 through 4. And as I require, tier 1 is a pretty good installation. And then you start putting in redundancies so that you can keep the system online no matter what goes wrong in your support facility. And you get up to tier 4, which is very, very expensive. I don't want to give the wrong impression on that at all. But we need a standard in order to talk about these things intelligently. And these people at the Uptime Institute do talk about intelligently, and they publish excellent documentation, which is referenced in TIA 942 in a very, very readable form. There's a column, generator. Do you need a generator? Do you need two generators? Do you need a load bank? I mean, it just answers the question directly. I am so pleased with that document, and I recommend it to anyone who has involvement with data centers. And the scary thing is the IT people didn't know about it. Oh, my gosh. National Electric Code Handbook includes a discussion of corrugated plastic fiber optic inner duct. What in the world is this? Well, you and I would call it Smurf duct. What is it? It's supposed to make it easier to pull fiber optic because you don't scrape along the whole wall of the conduit. You only scrape along the bumps of the corrugations. It looks like a dry vacuum cleaner hose, except it'll be 150 feet long. Again, I mentioned the steam tunnels a while back. All kinds of interduct hanging on the walls of the tunnels. And again, it's to protect, and I say that almost as a joke, protect the fiber optic cables. Fiber optic cables are remarkably robust. I mean, if you think glass, a hunk of glass is hard to break. But if you pinch it, suddenly it doesn't work anymore. The optical communication bounces off the kink in it. So it must not be bent. And that's what interduct does. It restricts you to a wide bend radius, which all the fiber optic people know. But the duct is a nice way to do it. And it's a bright orange, so you see it and you don't get you don't do bad things with recognizing that it's fiber optic and it's critical to the operation of the organization. So anyway, the National Electric Code includes a discussion of corrugated fiber optic interduct. That's what it's called. And one use is inside conduits. You can put three interducts inside a 4-inch conduit and have three independent fiber optic raceways. You don't mess with one while you're pulling another. So in your initial installation, you populate one with as many fibers as you need. You got two spares for the future, but you only ran one big conduit. Nice idea. A superior product, however, that I just discovered is Maxell, M-A-X-C-E-L-L. It's a cloth data space separator. It permits using up to 85% of a conduit cross-section. Now, if you visualize the three corrugated inner ducts inside a conduit, there's a problem there. Forgive me. There's the interstices, the triangle spaces between the inner ducts. You're not allowed to use that. And the corrugations, I mean, that's cross-sectional area you're using up and getting no communication cable in there. So inner duct in its actual application has some problems. This Maxell cloth data space separator avoids all those problems. It has very cleverly designed lapping cloth sections. You pull this through. You can either pull it through with the fiber or pull it through separately in the fiber later, and you can buy it with the pull strings already installed. But you use 85% of the cross section for fiber optic. It cannot be used loose in plenums or cable tray. Now, I don't have a picture of the Maxell cloth data space separator, but I do have a picture of conventional corrugated inner duct showing how it protects fiber optic cable and enforces acceptable bend radius. Now, join me as I read this picture to you. They've got a piece of basket tray going into a piece of ladder tray, and they've got a sharp 90 degree bend, and the corrugated inner duct is bent at a sharp 90 degrees, and it has a kink in it. And I had to hunt an awful long time to find a bad installation of inner duct. It's good stuff, and it's installed right, but we can still make a joke out of it, can't we? Next chapter is Chapter 8 on communication circuit. It deserves serious attention, and we will give it serious attention, but I'm going to take a break and suggest you do the same.